I'm Gary Noll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, peak food and the future of food security. We have a stellar panel lined up to share their insights on the problems and the solutions. First up will be Jeffrey Smith, followed by Professor David Montgomery, and then Dr. Peter Carter. Let's begin with Jeffrey Smith. Jeffrey Smith is one of the foremost experts on health and environmental risks of genetically modified organisms, commonly known as GMO crops and foods, and is a leading watchdog over corporate agricultural industry's manipulation of GMO genetic science and public opinion. He's currently the founding director for the Institute for Responsible Technology, which is a research and corporate watch organization devoted to informing the public about the truth of GMO foods and technology. Jeffrey is also the director for the Campaign for Healthier Eating in America. He's the author of two critical books on GMOs, Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette, the documented health risks of genetically engineered foods. He's also the director and writer of the documentary film Genetic Roulette, released in 2012. The book and film Genetic Roulette and the can all be found on the website responsibletechnology.org. Nice to have you with us today, Jeffrey.
Great to be here.
You're leading off our panel today. Last week we did our program on peak water. Next week it'll be on peak oil. We're at a point where there literally is only chaos theory. If you remember the Jeff Goldblum character in Jurassic Park, he was a chaos expert. And I actually met and filmed for this new documentary I'm doing the person whose character he was based upon. And I asked him a simple question. Once something starts to tip in our global crisis of many tipping points, is there any way to project how bad it can get and how fast? He said, no, there is none. He says, we are in chaos theory right now. And I said, explain that. And he explained that, let's say that you go to bed one night and everything seems fine and you've been led to believe that the water will not rise too much and certainly not where it would make a difference, even being noticeable to most people unless there's a storm. And there's a storm surge or a high tide. But for the vast majority of Americans, they'd be clueless about this. But then when you see large amounts of ice melting or large pieces of glacier going in from either Greenland or Antarctica, it's two major major peninsulas of ice, he said that could change everything overnight. He said that's entirely possible. Now, I've just completed 7 years of research on the tipping points. Four of those are or have tipped, and there's nothing we can do about it. Others we can still do something about. But people don't think about food as involved with any tipping point. They think, all right, it's hot or cold out. What does that have to do with food? I want to read from yesterday's front page headlines of the New York Times. From Adam Nagorny and Ian Lovett. Quote, a lack of water has the U.S. West fearing the worst. Well, I think it's important that I cite most of this article because it really falls right into what we're talking about in our program today. The punishing drought that has swept California and much of the West is confronting authorities with the worst water shortages this region has faced in more than a century, with near empty reservoirs, parched fields, starving livestock, clouds of smog, and outbreaks of wildfires. With no sign of significant rain, 17 rural communities in the state providing water to 40,000 people are in danger of running out of water within 60 to 120 days. California authorities announced Friday that they had no water left, none, in the State Water Project, the main municipal water distribution system, to supplement the dwindling supplies of local agencies that serve 25 million people. It is the first time the project has turned off the spigot in 54 years of its history. Quote, We're on track for having the worst drought in 500 years, said Professor Ingram, professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences, University of California, Berkeley. State officials said that in the worst case, they would truck drinking water into parched communities and drill additional wells to draw on groundwater. The deteriorating situation is likely to mean the imposition of mandatory water conservation measures for homeowners and businesses who have already been asked to voluntarily reduce their water supply by 20%. Already the drought, technically in the third year, is forcing big shifts in behavior. Farmers in rural Nevada said they had even given up on planting, while ranchers in Northern California and New Mexico said they were being forced to sell off cattle as fields that should have been 4 feet high in grass or blankets of brown and stunted stalks. And that's just on the first page. Then the entire inside page goes into depth about how they can't plan anything. Now, here's the first issue I'd like you to address, please. This is just one of 25 states in the United States that are in right now a chronic drought, year in, year out. There is nothing that's happening to help them, including Colorado, Georgia, Northern Florida, on the East Coast, and Alabama, but also Nevada, New Mexico. Albuquerque has had one of the driest winters in its history. Snowpack is not there. And then, of course, Kansas and Iowa, Utah. And what's happening is in Arizona, people who could have grown things now, if it was based upon the water that was available, can't. And so the average person going into their supermarket or a restaurant, they have plenty of food. They can't imagine that this would be a problem that they should be that concerned about. Tell us why we should be concerned and why what's happening in California could end up happening in more places, and they actually get a lot worse in California. Take your time.
Well, I can address the GMO piece of it. And the genetically modified crops, corn and soy, for example, require about twice as much water in order, the Roundup Ready crops. And we had a drought in the Midwest last year where there was a huge, huge economic impact on the production of soy and corn. And an agronomist told me that he suggested that the GMOs, the fact that they were water-hungry plants, may have caused a billion bushel shortfall. What happens with genetically engineered crops is not only does it require more water in the crop, but the Roundup, which is sprayed on the Roundup Ready crops, destroys beneficial bacteria in the soil. The beneficial bacteria in the soil, in part, supports a spongy-like texture which absorbs water. So when you end up killing that bacteria, then you can compactify the soil. So when observers look at two fields of cornfields, let's say, a Roundup Ready cornfield on the right, which has been sprayed with Roundup, and a non-genetically engineered cornfield on the left after a rain. After a rain, the cornfield on the right, the genetically engineered one, has puddles and runoff. The one on the left has no puddles because the water is absorbed into the soil. Now, we've been spraying Roundup at such huge amounts because of the Roundup Ready crops. We have a situation where it's found in 60 to 100% of the air samples, rain samples, and groundwater samples, as well as surface water samples in the United States. It's found in our urine. It's found in the urine of city dwellers in Europe. It is practically omnipresent. And it can last in the soil for years or decades. Now, that's one aspect in terms of the water. Another is that Roundup promotes the growth of soil-borne pathogens. And according to Dr. Don Huber, an expert and plant pathologist, more than 40 plant diseases are on the rise in the U.S. as a result of the use of Roundup. For example, sudden death syndrome in soy, Gauss's wilt in corn, huge economic problems for farmers And most do not realize that it's the Roundup promoting the growth of these fungal-based pathogens. Then we have also the aspect that Roundup deprives these plants of nutrition, of the trace minerals, because it chelates or binds with them. So we have weak and sick plants, which are fed to animals who now have a universal deficiency of certain trace minerals. And that, plus other problems, often GMO-related, are causing an epidemic of reproductive disorders, miscarriages, as well as sterility. Now, we look around in the human population, we see a similar thing. We see if you track the use of genetically modified crops or the use of Roundup, we see that when they were introduced in 1996, many of the diseases that we now hear from doctors who say that when people get off of GMOs, these diseases are alleviated, many of these diseases were rising sharply in parallel with the introduction of GMOs. So we look at gastrointestinal disorders, immune problems, diabetes, autism, high blood pressure, etc. So there are many tracks for the GMO issue which we can call a tipping point. One more, and that is that once you release the genes into the environment, they self-perpetuate. They cross-pollinate, the seeds move, and we have a self-propagating pollution of the gene pool which can last longer than the effects of global warming and nuclear waste. The only thing that lasts longer than a contaminated gene pool is extinction. Now, the biotech industry, Monsanto in particular, stated their goal to their Arthur Andersen consultant years ago, and that was to genetically engineer 100% of all commercial seeds in the world and patent them. And Andersen worked backwards from that goal to create the strategy and tactics to achieve it. So the company is planning to replace nature, to eliminate the products of the billions of years of evolution and replace it with their designer genes and designer organisms. And we know that that reduces dramatically the biodiversity available to farmers. In fact, they want to introduce the Terminator technology, which will eliminate seed saving because it will cause farmers to grow sterile seeds. The purpose of the Terminator technology is to target the 1.4 billion farmers who save seeds and as a result have millions of varieties, which is the source of the security in the food system. The diversity is the source of security in our food system, especially at a time of global climate change. But in the hands of Monsanto and the biotech industry, they want to eliminate the vast resources of saved seeds and force farmers to use just the limited genetics found in the catalogs, which puts the entire food system at risk for a blight, for a drought, etc. Now, our Institute for Responsible Technology, I don't want to leave you with this dire picture, because we're trying to engineer, and successfully at this point, a tipping point in the opposite direction, a tipping point of consumer rejection to force GMOs off the market. We saw it was a tipping point of consumer rejection in Europe that caused Unilever, then Nestle's, then virtually every other food company to commit to stop using GM ingredients in Europe in 1999. It was a tipping point that forced Walmart, Starbucks, Yoplait, Danone, and most American dairies to stop using genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. And it's a tipping point underway that has basically tipped the natural food industry to a non-GMO verified status, where the Whole Foods president said when a product becomes non-GMO project verified, it increases sales by 15% to 30%. Everyone in the natural food industry is rushing to become non-GMO project verified. And now grape nuts in the mainstream supermarkets, one of their varieties is non-GMO project verified. Cheerios has declared its original formula non-GMO. Target said their home brand will be non-GMO this year. Chipotle's, Ben & Jerry's, we are seeing the early signs. In fact, Gary, I heard some news recently that the Hartman Group did a survey, and 39% of Americans, that's about 120 million people, say that they are avoiding or trying to avoid consumption of GMOs. That's more than double what it was 6 years ago. So it is interesting that we are fighting one tipping point versus the other. a tipping point driven by the top of the food chain, consumers, to stop what could be a tipping point in the opposite direction, which would be a disaster for nature, for health, for water resources, etc.
Before we go to our next panelist, Jeffrey, as you mentioned, we're currently facing dramatic threats to the future of food security in both the developed and developing worlds on several fronts. You just highlighted some of the problems with GMOs and the Terminator seeds. One is the rapid increase in chemical industrial agricultural methods. Another is the movement away from biodiverse agriculture planning to monoculture, a single crop. Both of these, in turn, rely heavily upon chemical pesticides and fertilizers. These then relate to soil depletion and the loss of soil resilience, which Professor Montgomery will speak about. And on top of this, we're facing climate change and global warming impacts upon an already weakened big ag model that will further cause stresses upon our food production. So I'd like to have you look at what you see as the primary issue that has to be addressed, not just with genetic engineering to modify crops, and for Monsanto, as you said, working with the company to try to reverse engineer so they can control all this, but what this means to people in the rest of the world, in India, in Africa, and South America, who are also impacted.
Well, I think I'll talk about the two things in two different answers. One is what is happening, for example, in India with the introduction of GMOs, because that's a perfect example. And then I'll talk about a bigger solution that looks beyond the GMO issue. I was talking to a former Monsanto scientist, and I pointed out to him that there's no way he could guarantee that the GMO crops he was introducing will not cause an allergic reaction, possibly death, in some percentage of the population. And he agreed, but he said, but you know, we need genetic engineering because I've seen how India farms and we need to introduce it to more modern practices. Well, Monsanto bought up a major cottonseed distributor and has been pushing their miracle seeds in cotton as the road to riches for farmers. Well, in a quick summary, which we can talk about for hours, the cotton is not reliable that's genetically engineered and often doesn't even yield enough to allow the farmer to repay their high-interest loans with loan sharks on the secondary market. In India, the official number of farmer suicides over the past decade or so is 284,000, and about 250,000 of those are linked to the failure of BT cotton, Monsanto's cotton, in the hands of many of these farmers. And that is absolute catastrophe. There's also thousands of livestock that have died or gotten sick after eating the after harvest, they allow the animals to graze in the cotton fields to eat the plants. Many of them have died. I went into one village and all their buffalo died a few days after eating the cotton plants just for a single day. There's also thousands or millions of people getting allergic reactions, rashes, etc., from handling the cotton. So it's been a disaster, and it's not supporting sustainable agriculture. It's not supporting the economy, but it's being propped up by hype and a monopolistic situation where farmers cannot even access non-GMO seeds at the moment. From the bigger perspective, however, we can look at the ISTAD report, IAASTD. People can Google it. It was sponsored by the UN, the WHO, signed on by 58 countries. The most comprehensive evaluation of how to feed the world, eradicate poverty, and establish sustainable agriculture. And it was done over many years. First of all, they dismissed GMOs in their current state as having nothing to offer for feeding the world, eradicating poverty, or sustainable agriculture. What they said was agroecology. Agroecology is taking into consideration the local environment, agricultural practices, mixed planting, etc. I'm not an expert in agroecology, but as I travel around the world to about 40 countries, I'm often brought to places where they practice it. and I see and learn about nutrition per acre, total yield per acre, not just the yield of a particular monoculture per acre. It turns out that mixed planting provides more nutrition and more overall food per acre than the monocultures. The monocultures establish weakness in the entire ecosystem where they're created. They create weak plants, which then need to be propped up with these agricultural inputs. In fact, the entire industrial agricultural model, which was basically spawned after World War II because they had extra bomb material, which they turned into fertilizer, and extra nerve gas, which they turned into insecticides, is based on a model where they force the farmers to rely on inputs year after year. And in order to create that situation, they create a deficit in the ecosystem on the farm, a deficit of health in the soil, health in the plant, health in the entire system, which needs to be propped up from outside. But you now have experience with millions and millions of farmers around the world where they don't need to prop it up outside, and their yields are better and they're happier. In fact, a study with more than 12 million farms found that with sustainable methods of agriculture, the yield increased by 79% on average, with 100% increase in staples like corn and potatoes. And this is in contrast, for example, to genetic engineering, where it actually reduces average yield. That's in developing countries. In developed countries, they, you know, if you talk to a conventional farmer, they'll dismiss organic as being primitive, but the Rodale Institute did a side-by-side study for over 30 years, starting conventional versus organic and then GMO versus organic, and found that there was no difference in yield except in times of bad weather where the stronger ecosystem around the organic plants made them yield more. So again, in a time of climate change and unknown weather patterns, organic is going to work better for you in the developed countries for sure, and the sustainable and organic can yield far more in the developing world, and it'll provide the balanced nutrition, whereas the Roundup Ready crops kill all of the other plant biodiversity by spraying Roundup over the top of the field, and only the genetically engineered crops survive the dosage of Roundup. What we're killing, we call weeds, the developing country calls food. The rich plant biodiversity on their field is important for their nutrition. We had found that when the Green Revolution was introduced with high input monoculture agriculture, then it also was followed in the path a deficit in nutrition. And I saw a presentation actually done at the World Food Prize where it was supporting the notion of the Green Revolution, but these scientists had to give them a wake-up call where they talks about actually a reduction in nutrition, an increase in malnutrition in the wake of the Green Revolution.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Please stay there. Professor David Montgomery is a geomorphologist and an environmentalist in the Earth and Space Sciences Division, the University of Washington's College of the Environment in Seattle. He specializes in the evolution of geological topography and the influence of geomorphological processes on ecological systems and human societies. His research has taken him worldwide, the Cascade Range in the Pacific Northwest, to the Andes, the Himalayas, and the Tibetan Plateau. He is the author of Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, a very important study about the role soil and erosion has played in the rise and collapse of civilization and society. His most recent book is The Rocks Don't Lie, A Geologist Investigates Noah's Flood. And he's with us now. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
When we look at what we're talking about today, and that is peak food, there's the assumption that you have what you need, you just have to grow the right things. We don't want GMO crops, we want sustainable crops, we want mixed crops. But we have to also look at what is the soil that we're working with? What's in that? Does it have enough water? Does it have enough material from which plants can grow? Monoculture has destroyed an enormous amount of our topsoil. And that's also true in India and other countries. So take us on a in-depth analysis, if you would please, of what the average person just doesn't give much thought to, and that's the essential importance of soil, dirt, and And as a soil scientist who has also studied extensively the relationship between good and poor soil stewardship and the collapse of past civilizations, educate us about the fundamental importance of the dirt we rely upon for agriculture. Take your time, please.
Okay. Well, if you look at all the environmental crises that we face this century, the one that probably gets the least attention is the problem of soil loss and degradation. People tend to view agriculture as, well, you'll often hear people view agriculture as a technological problem. You know, we need GMOs, for example, one of the big crazy talks of the 21st century, or that organic agriculture can't feed the world, the second biggest lie perhaps of the 21st century. But people don't tend to look at soil and its degradation at the same kind of crisis level as big droughts or major volcanic eruptions, changes in the atmosphere from climate change. Yet it is. It's happening at a pace that's fairly slow year to year. But it's a pace that, if you play things out over the long run the way a geologist likes to think, we face a fairly big crisis from the simple math that the human population is still going up. Agricultural yields are not going up dramatically at present. In fact, there's evidence that they're falling to some degree. And the amount of fertile land that we have available for agriculture has been declining since the Second World War as we've degraded and taken land out of production. There's not a lot of land in the world that could actually be used for long-term agricultural production today that isn't already being used for it. The Amazon basin, for example, you're not going to be able to farm long-term sustainably given the nutrient-poor nature of the soils there. The nutrients are all in the forest canopy, so when you clear the forest, you stop nutrient cycling, you're not going to be able to sustain agriculture for a long time. And this problem of soil degradation in the past and can be viewed essentially as having two components. There's the quality of the soil, the fertility of the soil, and there's the presence of the soil itself. And to generate a sustained or sustainable agriculture, we've really basically got to take care of both, maintain the fertility of the soil and maintain the presence of the soil. And a lot of the problems that your previous speaker identified in terms of what he's looking at as GMO agriculture are actually shared in common with large-scale monocultures, and particularly those that are very chemically dependent, as is modern agriculture in the developed world. The loss of soil life that he talked about is a huge impact in terms of soils, their ability to hold water, as he was identifying. And that destruction and loss of soil biota is probably one of the really big under-acknowledged negative impacts on our long-term agricultural resilience that we really do need to address this century. We're finding out that the soil biota are essential for cycling nutrients, for maintaining the transfer of micronutrients and major elements from rocks to the soil to plants. And I think we've barely scratched the surface on understanding the potential long-term health impacts for human populations that eat food that's grown in essentially life-depauperate soil, soil that does not have those microbial helpers in terms of moving nutrients out of the earth and into our food at the levels that we evolved to actually have them, micronutrients in particular. You can look at fertilizers as adding the major chemical elements to the soils as essentially adding up to maybe the bulk chemistry of food. But the minor components actually really do matter to the way that we function. If you look at rates of soil loss around the world today, you can come up with a kind of alarming number that we're losing about, half a percent or so of our fertile topsoil off of croplands each year, which is a small number on a year-to-year basis, but you add that up over a century, and it starts to look like a pretty big dark cloud over the future of humanity. We're going to have to change our agriculture this century, if only to conserve physically the body of soil in those areas in the world that we actually use to grow our food. And the world has a lot of different kinds of soils. Some are far more fertile naturally than others. But human activity is probably the biggest variable in the world today in terms of maintaining soil fertility. And in the interest of bringing up a positive note, one of the things I've noted in the few years since I wrote Dirt in visiting farmers around the world and across the American Midwest, there's an awful lot of farmers practicing very progressive farming methods that, as your previous guest indicated, can actually increase their yields or maintain yields so that they're comparable to what you get with modern or so-called modern industrialized chemically-based agriculture. You can do as good a job with a yield, even in a monoculture, with progressive and sustainable practices. You know, we could argue about whether monocultures are sustainable. And your previous guest was also right in identifying that the best way to generate the most food off of a piece of land is not to grow one crop, it's to grow a diversity of crops. You look at the highest crop yields per hectare from farms around the planet, and they're grown on small-scale organic farms that practice polyculture, growing many different crops, whether intercropped on the same field or with crop rotations and successively. You get more output from the land with progressive practices than you can from the same piece of land with industrialized agriculture. And that's why I like to call the idea that organic can't feed the world is the biggest lie of the 21st century, because buried in that assertion are assumptions about the way we practice agriculture. And we've gone through something like four major agricultural revolutions in the history of humanity so far. This century, we're due for another one, if only for the very simple reason that we're maintaining the productivity of our soils in the developed world with a fossil fuel subsidy. And if there's one thing that's probably going to change by the end of this century, it's either the price of fossil fuels or our collective vision of the wisdom of actually relying on them as the climate starts to change out from under civilization. Agriculture is going to change this century. The real question is how. And arguing for progressive agricultural practices and adopting them today is really a good way to guarantee that people tomorrow will have enough to eat.
When we have an agricultural paradigm that relies, as you mentioned, so heavily upon chemical fertilizers to sustain the crop and plant nutrients necessary for large-scale industrial farming, from a scientific perspective, how does this further decrease soil quality? And what's the predictable time frame soil can last when abused in this way?
Well, if you look at soil fertility as the variable, essentially a very chemically intensive agriculture does is it changes the soil biota. And one of the things that we've discovered in the last 20, 30 years or so, or what soil scientists have discovered, is the highly specialized degree of microbial adaptations and mycorrhizal fungal adaptations between soil life and plants and crops. There's particular microbes that tend to work in partnership with crops, trading nutrients back and forth, literally scavenging micronutrients, trading to the plants for sugars, coating their roots to help fend off pathogens. There's this whole incredible world of microbial ecology that's happening beneath the ground and kind of out of sight and out of mind from our perspective, but that actually turns out to be a major player in maintaining soil fertility, the ability of the land to actually keep producing healthy crops. And what we've kind of done with chemical agriculture since the Second World War is replaced our reliance on that native soil fertility, the ability of the soil to break down nutrients and get them into plants. And we're essentially just trying to feed the plants directly by dumping nutrients into the soil. In doing so, we've managed to change, poison, if you will, the native soil biota that are the source of resilience in terms of agriculture. So what happens if we actually get to a point where either the price of fertilizers get high enough that it's not competitive, or that we need to go, or we literally sort of run out of fossil fuel-based fertilizers? If we've in the interim destroyed the native ability of the soil to be fertile itself, we're basically setting ourselves up for the kind of fall that ancient societies experienced when they literally plowed themselves out of fertile soil.
Finally, on this issue, talk about what the average person who's looking at the lack of sustainability is. I opened the program, as you remember, talking about what just happened yesterday and what is now going to be a disaster for 25 million people living in California. The primary source of their water, supported by the government, is gone. It's off. The tap is dry. They have to rely upon drilling new wells by the existing aquifers. by streams, but all those are down as well and are going to get lower. So quite simply, if a person is honest, and that's what we've been lacking in our entire discussion in this society when it comes to being honest about the environment and its impact upon us, because look at it from this point of view. It's a no-win situation. If you're a politician, if you're a governor, if you're a mayor, if you're a county supervisor, and you have to tell the truth that your community cannot be sustainable in the future, and therefore you're running out of water or some other manifestation of the oceans coming in, and you're going to have storm surges, the property values would plummet. The bubbles that have supported our society for the last 10 years would burst. There'd be a collapse in confidence. People would be looking for other places to leave. The tax base would plummet. Infrastructure would crumble, and crime would soar. And agriculture would dry up. Now, right now in California, you've got the largest amount of agriculture in the United States. In fact, it makes billions of dollars for the California economy. And if it comes to where that 1 million acres, they talked today about 1 million acres being taken out, 200,000 this year alone has been taken out. 1 million acres is a devastating amount of crops to take out, because that's where our strawberries, our raspberries, our lettuces, and so many other things come from. Then you're talking about a serious upheaval, a game changer for a lot of people. We never talk about that. We're afraid to. We're afraid to tell the Americans the truth. So right now, when you look at California, you look at Arizona, virtually going to be unsustainable in the very near future, I predict, and other states as well. What is the answer for those people who want to sustain themselves, want to rely upon organic and natural means of helping themselves? What advice do you give them?
Boy, well, there's essentially sort of the fine focus and then the policy level of the broad focus. And on the fine focus, on sort of what individuals can do, one of the things I've been really impressed with in Seattle in the last few years is just the extent to which ties between the urban environment and local agriculture have grown, and the amount of farmers markets and connections, direct connections between farmers practicing farming in ways that actually improve the land and build resilience and build the capacity to actually grow more food, are being supported by urban populations. To me, that's a sort of it's not at the level of a game changer yet, but you play it out over time and it could actually have a very big impact. At sort of at a broader focus of, in terms of, say, national policy, I think that we have a really hard time dealing with slow changes. I mean, climate change, which is presumably part of the engine behind the great drought in California. Once in 500 years, it's either a very awkward circumstance, or is it the harbinger of things to come? It brings up the wisdom of thinking about resilience of systems rather than sort of short-term production on them, and we're really bad at thinking that way as a society. As a species, we're not that great about doing long-term planning. We're really good at reacting to things in the moment. But I think that the example that you bring up is a really good reminder about how we really need, if we're going to survive as a civilization through the next 100 years, we really have to start thinking about resilience. You can call it sustainability if you want to call it that, but at the heart of it, we've got to be thinking about things, creating social systems and infrastructure and the way we grow food that is resilient to disturbance, that will actually not be as prone to the kind of collapse that you're mentioning, because you look back at the history of ancient societies, and there are evidence of societies that have gone through this before. We need to learn their lessons and apply them to our own future.
Give us a couple of these lessons, and then give us the lesson of the Great Dust Bowl, when 10% of all farming land in the United States was so severely affected and eroded that nothing would grow there, and that caused a massive migration and the loss of hundreds of thousands of homes.
Yeah, the Dust Bowl caused a huge social dislocation, but it was not the first one in history that the degradation of the land by people actually led to. You can look back at classical Greece or the Roman Empire, the whole societies around the Mediterranean, Easter Island, parts of China. There's lots of parts of the world where you can point to the sustained influence of ancient agricultural practices that resulted in erosion of the soil at a pace faster than the soil was being rebuilt from rocks that broke down and weathered to make new soil. If that's out of balance, if you're eroding soil faster than it's being replaced, and you let that run for long enough, you can literally thin the soil out to the place where you're left with nothing but much but rocky hill slopes. And this has happened in society after society, but at a pace that's really slow. It's hard enough to kind of, it's slow enough to hardly notice over an individual lifetime, but you play it out for generations and centuries, and you can be left with something like, Lebanon, for example. It's not thought of as the most fertile, rich, verdant part of the world, and yet it used to host great cedars that could rival the old-growth timber in my home state of Washington. What happened? Why is it impoverished? It's how they treated their soil. They basically lost most of it. And that lesson is one that is, it's very pertinent to thinking about the future of our society, and the Dust Bowl is even closer to home. It's one, I like to call it the biggest man-made natural disaster that I know of, because there had been something like 13 comparable droughts that had struck the American Midwest in the last several thousand years that didn't cause, great clouds of soil to blow all the way from Kansas to the eastern seaboard. And what was the difference? Well, it was the opening and the plowing of the plains. The grass was what was actually holding the plains together. Vegetation is a really good way to hold soil in place. And one of the curses of plow-based agriculture, sort of modern conventional agriculture, is that if the soil is bare and vulnerable to wind or rain, it's going to erode faster than it's being reformed because it forms very, very slowly. The good news is that in the same way that people can, by the flip side of the way that people can degrade soil and lose it faster than it's formed, we can also build soil faster than nature does it. And there's good examples, again, from history of societies that built soil fertility while intensively using and farming their land. So it's the problem is not really that we farm. The problem is the way that we farm. And that's why I was saying earlier that we need another agricultural revolution. And the agroecology that your previous guest mentioned is exactly in the right direction that we need to go. Okay. We basically need a global agroecology revolution that through which we focus on working with soil biota, building soil fertility, and feeding the soil to feed the life that then feeds us.
I think you're absolutely correct, but I believe that we have to have thousands of small biodynamic farms that are doing this and supporting local communities, supporting homesteading movements, supporting movement back to the land, where it becomes a quantitative shift in consciousness. As Marilyn Ferguson said in her Aquarian Conspiracy, when enough people begin to see the reality of something working, it creates a shift in the paradigm. And I believe that that is one of the directions we'll go in because more and more people are waking up. Thank you for your input on that.
I think we are starting to see that, and that's a good thing. It needs a push, though.
I agree. Dr. Peter Carter is a medical doctor. We're speaking with him from British Columbia. And he's practiced medicine for over 40 years, both in England and the United States. And he has become actively involved in the environmental, climate change, and sustainable development issues. He is the founding director of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment and the founder of Climate Emergency Institute. And he's also an expert reviewer of the IPCC Fifth Climate Change Assessment. He has presented on sustainable development, environmental health policy, and biodiversity. And he is with us now. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed listening to your very interesting speakers. Very, very good show.
I'd like to take a little different approach because all things involving the environment are integrated and interrelated. And we can't use just what's happening in Canada or the United States. We have to look at what's happening in where weather patterns are changing the precipitate matter and changing rich, fertile soil that once existed now into, like in South America, one-fifth of the entire rainforest in Brazil has now been eroded to make room for soybeans, for genetically engineered soybeans, to feed China's and other countries' growing appetite for affluent foods, pork.
That's
and beef.
Right.
So I'd like you to address the issue of the fundamental criteria for seasonal agriculture is dependable climate patterns. Yet this is what is most changing through climate change, such as droughts in California and Australia. Australia is having the worst year in its history. So take us through a variety of climate change and global warming threats to sustainable agriculture and the future of food security that we are witnessing already.
Well, first of all, international climate change and food conferences that I've been lucky enough to present at, the leaders of the experts, and I'm not an expert in this. My experience is in environmental health protection policy, and so naturally, over the past 10 years, as you say, I've pretty well focused everything on global warming and climate change. But the experts are saying they're not talking about food security anymore. They're talking about food insecurity. My particular aspect, which I present on, because it's not so far covered by the science very much, is what is our committed global warming today? I noted that you said that we should take an integrated approach, and there are two problems with our science. Our science is absolutely amazing. It's quite astounding, but there are two problems with it from the point of view of assessing and coming to terms with global warming, climate change, and ocean acidification, because the problem really is atmospheric greenhouse gas pollution. Okay, we have a pollution problem. And that's what results in the fact that we have a very, very much higher degree of warming that we are locked into today. And that's called commitment. So the two problems with the science, and the scientists that I know are the first to acknowledge this, is that, number one, it's not integrated. The IPCC is a great attempt to try and do that, but so far they acknowledge that, you know, they have a long way to go. Because our scientific institution and our whole scientific approach is reductionism, siloed. And so we have one group of scientists studying, one that in actual fact is very interesting to me is Jennifer Francis from Rutgers University, and she's studying very complicated jet streams and waves that affect the atmosphere, and she says are probably attributing to the California drought. From the Arctic loss of snow and sea ice. And you can go on. But the scientists have a huge problem because they're not really supposed to, in fact, comment on the science of other specialties. Okay, so that's a big problem. The other problem that we have is modeling. Now, modeling is, these are computer models. And this is relatively recent. I've seen this come in and grow and grow and grow and increase in, it's quite astounding what the models can do. However, the things that we would like the models to do for climate change and food security, they still can't do. And they probably never will, in fact, because we are introducing an increasing amount of chaos into the climate system. The climate is a naturally chaotic system, but not very chaotic for the past 10,000 years, and that has allowed us to, human beings, to make our greatest invention, which is agriculture. I mean, you know, it's not only an invention that we're completely dependent on now, and quite properly, it's an amazing invention. It's our number one achievement, agriculture. This should be recognized, of course, a lot more than it is. We tend not to because we all go to our supermarkets and we can buy whatever we want to, and so we don't really see that agriculture is a great achievement and a great invention, but also the other side of the coin is it's very sensitive. It's rather fragile. And your speakers are absolutely right, who said that this a theme that I heard repeated over and over, and it bears repeating over and over, is that our agriculture has become more and more and more and more specialized. Okay? And, you know, you can't sort of blame anybody for that, but it's the last thing you want if you're going to have climate change. I often think to myself, I grew up in a country in England. I lived on a farm for a while, and you know what we've known for, we've known since 1990 because James Hansen in 1988, his famous historic presentation to Congress, said we would get more heat waves in the United States, we would get more drought in the United States, and we will get more probably, he wasn't so certain about this, but he said we're probably going to get more extreme weather events of other kinds, okay? So when I was a boy in England talking to farmers around, you know, if we'd have asked them, well, you know, we think we're going to change the climate a little bit. What do you think? Well, they said, they'd say you're absolutely crazy. Do not mess with the climate, okay? And this is what we're doing. So, the highly specialized monocrop agriculture dependent on large amounts of chemicals, we're really going to have to, you know, people are talking about adapting, of course, to climate change now. I hate to say that that's folly because we're forced to do it, but we better not expect that it's going to work. So certainly, yes, the FAO, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, who I consult with, they periodically ask for input from various experts and people on questions they're looking at. And over the past 2 years, they have in actual fact said that it's looking like the smallholder, small-scale agriculture is going to be more adaptable to climate change, and not the big business monoculture agriculture, which I want to stress is in itself a huge achievement. I mean, the amount of food that the United States produces in these regions, it is astounding. When you have a look at it, it seems to be unbelievable. Okay. But that's also highly vulnerable now to climate change and global warming, and that, fortunately, has finally been acknowledged just over the past couple of years, as I've already indicated from the FAO. We have been lulled into complacency in the Northern Hemisphere, and particularly in the States, because the governments have relied on climate models that have been very, very, very incomplete. And they have, until the last IPCC assessment in 2007, they had actually projected that the Northern Hemisphere best world food-producing regions and the United States would possibly benefit from global warming and climate change. And this sense is stuck in the minds of government departments, policymakers, and governments all over the Northern Hemisphere. And myself and other people, we're trying to sort of wake up the governments to what the latest science is saying. Because bureaucracies have this great inertia, rather like the climate system. So there were two very important reports out this year in 2013 from the United States. One was the latest federal climate change assessment, and the other was the Federal Department of Agriculture, who this year also did a climate change and agriculture assessment. Their findings should have been much more publicized because they are indeed terribly alarming. Their findings are that there would be mixed effects of global warming and climate change. So, and I want to stress that this is absolutely different to what we've been hearing prior to 2012. There'll be mixed effects. There may be some improvements. There's going to be some losses. There're going to be some adverse effects. But they say that by mid-century, the United States, based on these incomplete models, that, by the way, exclude prolonged drought, for example. Exclude prolonged drought, they can't model it. The agricultural productivity in the United States will decline. Now, that's 2050. Now, why do I say that I am so alarmed and concerned about that? Well, it's because of the climate system inertia. We are locked in to global warming, temperature increase, and climate change for the next 30 years. So we're locked in to climate change projections for 2040. So when you read government reports by many, many scientists, best scientists in the world, of course, in agriculture in the States, the input of many scientists that are saying, well, crop yields are going to decline by 2050, we are in big, big trouble. I mean, we are already losing food. And when you take that, and this is why you've got to have a holistic look at things, you've got to have an integrated look at things, as you so rightly said at the outset, when you have that on all of these vulnerabilities that are built into our agricultural system with regards to climate change, I mean, it is a huge and tragic irony. I mean, obviously, nobody foresaw or planned this. But yes, we have soil degradation. That's the last thing you want with climate change, because with climate change, you're going to get more droughts. Everybody is agreed on that. We will get more droughts. They're going to be longer. They're going to be more severe. We're also going to get more heavy rains and storms and floods. And both of those seem to be extremes as regards weather and climate, but they both produce loss of soil. They both produce soil erosion. And one of the land degradation aspects, of course, that your speakers were referring to is the soil erosion, which has affected the Great Plains and Canada and the United States. Now, no-till agriculture, you know, the speakers were talking about the effect of the plow. And no-till agriculture, I gather, because I've been interested in looking into this, has been making great progress. Under governmental advice in both the United States and Canada. So we've certainly changed towards that, but we have this agricultural system, you see, which is actually not adaptable. It's not resilient, right? Because it's so highly specialized on a particular climate, on particular seasons, okay, and then on particular technological and chemical input. So, yeah, they're absolutely right. I mean, we're going to have a revolution in agriculture.
Well, we think we are. In fact, we see it. And I very much appreciate Dr. Peter Carter from British Columbia, you bringing your insights, formidable as they are, to help this public. And Jeffrey Smith from Iowa, thank you for all the good work that you're doing out there. And hopefully people will watch Genetic Roulette as well as read the book Seeds of Deception. And Professor David Montgomery from Seattle, Washington, and the author of The Rocks Don't Lie, as well as his earlier work, Dirt. And I saw a documentary about earlier this year called Dirt, and I don't know if that was yours as well. But thank you for all of your good work. For my panel, thank you. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, the topic, Peak Food and the Future of Food Security. We showed the problems, and we showed some solutions. Have a nice day.